But I heard it and I thought, I can't believe this was written in 1929. What along those lines strikes you about this production? And I guess, you know, that leads into why it was selected for the third years.
Well, last year I was on your show to talk about Detective Story, which was the first play I directed at School of the Arts. In the fall of the third year, it's our third year students' coming out party. Mm-hmm. We're training actors, and the first 2 years they're doing classroom projects and taking classes in voice and speech and acting and singing and dancing and stage combat and theater movement. So we're training them as young artists. And then in the third year, they finally step out on stage. And we invariably wind up doing one or two really big plays for them to kind of take their first stab at working on a full-length vehicle. And Detective Story last year seemed like a perfect kind of choice, a big naturalistic American play with a wide variety of characters in a heated situation, passionate, a classic American play. And Street Scene is that times two. It's one of the biggest, most difficult plays in the classical American naturalist canon. Elmer Rice's play calls for 54 speaking roles in its original rendition, and we're doing it with 40 actors, two children, and a dog. It's a giant cross-section of life in early 20th century New York City, and it's an amazing challenge for our actors. It all takes place in one day and covers a wide range of passions, loneliness and courage and bravery and violence and fear and love and everything you might wish. It's a full menu of acting challenges. So it's a great choice for us and a thrilling play to get to do.
A full menu, I think of a full life, at least an interesting life for the playwright himself, Elmer Rice. Who was this guy?
Yeah, Elmer Rice. You know, the play really tells you who he was. The play is very autobiographical. The parts of his life are in all of the main characters. And he was a man who had a very distant father, but had a lot of love and support from an uncle and a grandfather. And his grandfather, most notably, was a Jewish emigrant who was a socialist and an atheist, and kind of taught Elmer Rice and gave to Elmer Rice his political proclivity. He was a young man. You know, his parents were very chagrined because he spent all his time reading. And they were very worried that he'd never amount to anything because he was such a bookworm. And he said, I think a quote from him is something along the lines of, "The most important thing I ever got was a library card."
Yeah, it's a great quote.
Yeah, it's wonderful because he is a real man of letters. And he was part, you know, in the second part of his career, he was part of probably one of the most important producing entities, and one that's really forgotten today. He and a group of four other playwrights, including Robert Sherwood and Robert Anderson, started a group called the Playwrights Circle, and they produced like 40 or 50 plays on Broadway over a period of time in the middle of the 20th century. And they, you know, between them, they were doing their own work and work by other writers, and they really pushed the envelope of what American playwriting was capable of. They were sort of the descendants of O'Neill, and they created everything from, you know, high comedy to tragedy and everything in between. Rice's career himself, I think, was really expanded by his association with all these other writers. He was a frequent collaborator with other people, including Dorothy Parker, who he wrote a play with and had a tour d'affaire with at one point. But he wrote, you know, this play, which is a real classic American tragedy, a wonderful kind of fantasy comedy called Dream Girl in the 40s. And in between the two of them, really one of the two or three classics of American Expressionist theater, amazing play called The Adding Machine. And so between those three plays, he's working in three very distinct genres and creating three 20th century American classics.
The Adding Machine was one that really spoke to the idealism streak within him. And just could you just outline the theme of that play, which I thought was really clever?
The Adding Machine is a play about a man who is kind of caught up in the cogs of modern society.
His name is Zero.
Mr. Zero. Mr. Zero. And Mr. Zero gets caught up in the cogs and he's replaced by an adding machine. Progenitor of a computer, one would assume, and he dies, and then he goes to heaven, where it's also deemed that he's surplus to requirements, and so he's recycled and sent back to Earth again. Dystopian fantasy.
One of his ongoing frustrations was that, well, I mean, these great idealistic works and hyper-realism or whatever the term was to describe them, it never made him any money, but the other works did. I mean, I'm curious to get the audience members' take on this play in 1929, you know, recognized by the Pulitzer Committee. But, I mean, what were audiences thinking, seeing
It's very interesting because he was trained as a lawyer. And so he had a lawyer's storytelling sense, which is to say there's a real sense of argument in his plays. And actually wrote a couple courtroom dramas that were really well received, including Counselor at Law. And, you know, it's funny, you know, one reads often about the fact that he was frustrated that the plays he thought were the best weren't the commercial successes. But he made enough money in his lifetime to buy the Belasco Theater. So he didn't do terribly over the long haul. His sensibility about street scene, what's so interesting is that it was more unconventional in its day than it seems now. This idea of a kind of slice of life, a broad panoply of characters that gets sort of, you have to sift your way through the play to figure out who it's about, actually. Mm. It's amazing how late the point of attack in the play is. Even though it only takes place over one day, it takes us a number of pages before we're introduced to the main pair in the play, Sam and Rose. And Sam and Rose, I don't think, have their first conversation until almost 40 pages into the play. Mm. So we're introduced to a huge swath of New York City before we kind of narrow our focus down to these two principal characters.
Disorienting naturalism was the word I was groping for.
Yeah. It's wonderful because, of course, part of the fun of it is discovering who the play's about. As you enter into the world of the play, you're kind of grasping around, trying to pick up the threads. And audiences are like detectives. You know, they're interested in where plays are going, and they're hungry for plot. And so they're interested to pick through. And part of the fun of this thing is that as you are introduced to this wide swath of characters, you begin to slowly but surely find your way through the maze of them to the kind of core heart of the play.
And at one character in particular, Rose, talking about this idea of not, you know, being in love but not wanting to belong to someone and needing to find yourself and the strength that comes from that.
Yeah, the play is about these two young people trying to discover who they are. Mm. And as such, it's a kind of perfect metaphor for what we're doing at School of the Arts. Mm. But it's wonderful the notion of loneliness in the play. I mean, that's one of my favorite parts of it because, of course, it's a play about the slums of New York and the really difficult tenement living of these hardscrabble lower middle class people who are all eking out livings and living in close quarters. But within that universe, there's deep loneliness. Mm. You know, there's that old saying that New York is the loneliest city in the world because there's nothing like being surrounded by a bunch of people who are indifferent. I remember reading this summer an extraordinary article that said that they worked for years to discover why people who were in a poverty situation made bad nutrition choices. And that there had long been a sort of anecdotal evidence that it was because they weren't educated about nutrition. And so they'd made great efforts to educate a test population, and they found that that didn't change it. And so then there was another speculation that, well, maybe it was because of speed or convenience of fast food. And so they made it cheaper and just as easy to get healthy food. And again, they didn't make good decisions. And finally, it took neurologists studying this population to discover that, in fact, the reason they made bad decisions was that their actual mental capacity, like anyone's would be, was so taxed at the number of decisions they had to make that poverty actually induced a constant level of very, very high stress. Because you had to make a choice about, well, do we eat or do we pay the heat? Do we pay the rent or do we pay the heat? Do we buy books for school or do we buy food? And the number of choices they literally had to make overwhelmed their capacity to make intelligent, informed choices. And that as soon as they relieved some of the decision-making burden, immediately people began to make better choices. And I thought that was so extraordinary. And I also thought, well, if they just read Street Scene, they wouldn't have had to do that study. Because, of course, like, we see people groping desperately to make good decisions, but the number of decisions they have to make are overwhelming them.
So, Carl, you were kind of called off the bench to pitch in here in not great circumstances. How is Matt Bullock doing?
He's doing great. Matt Bullock is a longtime faculty member on the acting faculty at School of the Arts and a terrific friend. And Matt had surgery a few weeks ago and had to leave the production. And so 4 weeks into a 7-week process, I've stepped in as the fill-in director, and I'm just trying not to mess up all the beautiful work he did.
Well, I know the students appreciate that. And what sort of feedback are you getting from the young actors?
Well, it's such a challenging play. You know, it's very interesting. I think people who aren't in the theater are often surprised when I try to explain to them the intense difficulty of a very, very small role. I have some parts in my play. There's an amazing, really challenging role of one of the women who lives in the tenement building the play takes place in. And she has to constantly come in and say one line and then leave. And the difficulty of that is that you need to have a life going on that we only see a little tiny piece of. And so the amount of work that's required to be able to walk on and without tons of stress and tension deliver that one line and be seeking something and yearning for connection and have all the loneliness and life and fullness that everybody else has, but not be pressing or trying too hard to draw attention to oneself, to flow seamlessly in and out of the world of the play that way, is an enormous challenge. And I think some of the actors playing the smaller roles have been surprised at the degree of difficulty of that. You know, they're getting ready to play giant roles where they're on stage for hours at a time, and they're amazed at the challenge of playing these roles that are 1 minute of stage time in the first act and then three in the second act.
What can you do in terms of direction, Carl, to instill in that actor who maybe has a periodic role, a short line here and there, that sense of arch of continuity, so that then when they deliver that line, it has a place?
Well, as ever in the school of theater that we inherited from Stanislavski, we're asking actors to focus outside themselves. That actors who are thinking about themselves and worried about how they look or seem or feel invariably bring a self-consciousness that's less interesting than if they're really outward focused, if they really are taking in their partners and the scene and what's happening outside them and trying to affect change on the world around them. And that's enormously difficult to do because one can't help but being a bit self-conscious when 300 people are expectantly staring at one. But there's this other thing, of course, which is that the more nuanced and developed their story is about what happened before they walked on and after they leave, the more that through line feels lived in and full, the more chance they have of being able to enter into that truth. Mm-hmm. So it's a ton of creative imagining about these people's lives and who they are and where they're going and what they're doing. One thing about Street Scene that's worth noting is that I said this to the cast when I took over the show from Matt, and it's something that I've thought many times at school, which is that we have a sort of extraordinary opportunity over there to do plays that are beyond the grasp of almost every producing entity in the country. And I felt this way about Detective Story as well. When you're talking 40 actors, two kids, and a dog in 100 costumes, you're talking about a play complexity of which is beyond most professional companies. And so I really think it falls in some ways to the elite training institutions to keep these plays in the repertory, to keep these plays alive. Lincoln Center, as great and amazing as they are, to do Street Scene would be an almost superhuman investment from them.
And just in terms of investment sense, I mean, dollars.
Oh, my God. I can't really even begin to imagine. I mean, I think to do Street Scene on Broadway now is $5 million of upfront money, something like that. So for us to do it at the level that we're capable of doing it at, I think is an important part of really the entire American theatrical landscape. This play lives by being done. And so I feel really proud and called to do work on that scale with the School of the Arts because we are someone who can do it. We can keep that work alive.
And do it extremely well.
We try.